Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Hey folks, I am super excited to tell you a bit about today's new sponsor, Music Masters Collective. They're a nonprofit organization that produces unique music events, providing opportunities for fans and artists to meet and collaborate in an inspired and creative atmosphere. Every week, MMC hosts different events, all with the opportunity to learn from world-class musicians like Bill Frisell, Kurt Rosenwinkel, Julian Lage, Mark Ribot, Wayne Krantz, Oteil Burbridge, the Milk Carton Kids, and so many more. At an event like Alternative Guitar Summit Camp happening this August, you can expect in-depth workshops with guitar masters, once-in-a-lifetime performances, the opportunity to play alongside your favorite musicians, and a lot of fun. You'll leave this event packed full of wisdom and with a whole community of musicians to create with. This all-inclusive week in the Catskills Mountains of upstate New York is guaranteed to be magical. Scholarships are available. Spots are extremely limited. So visit www.alternativeguitarsummitcamp.com/moods to learn more.
Osiris.
Moods and Modes is presented by Osiris Media and made possible thanks to our Patreon community. To support the podcast directly, go to patreon.com/Alex Skolnick.
From Brooklyn, New York, this is Moods and Modes. I'm your host, Alex Skolnick. I'm probably best known as a professional guitarist. I'm also a writer, a photographer, and someone who occasionally gets told to keep his opinions to himself on Twitter. This podcast will involve music and guitar, but it may take us to some unexpected places as well. So, thank you for joining me, and let's do this.
What's happening, everybody? This is Alex. Welcome to Moods and Modes, episode 35. Very special guest today that you're hearing in the background. That is the one and only Hail Storm. How does that to start your day? Or maybe you're listening at night. I don't know. Either way, you're going to feel quite a burst of energy when you hear these guys, because they are, as Sensei Johnny Lawrence of Cobra Kai might say, I have been watching that show, they are badass rockers. Whew. That song's like audio caffeine. Can you believe there was ever a debate about whether girls could rock? Well, that debate's over. Thank you, Lizzie Hale, who is one of my guests, along with Joe Hottinger, the guitarist. And, of course, Lizzie also plays guitar and has a signature guitar, which we're going to talk about. Oh, and it's made by Gibson and really lives up to, like, the best of what Gibson has to offer. And we're going to bring in Lizzie and Joe momentarily. Before we do, I just want to do a little bit of brief housekeeping up front. And I suppose you could say I've reverted to the more typical practice in podcast land, which is doing housekeeping up front. Now, those of you who have listened for a long time know that I tend to kick off the episode and go straight for the jugular or the subject matter at hand and reserve any housekeeping for a short break that would happen at the halfway point, usually on the half hour. We're still going to do those short breaks in the middle, but this way we can keep them short and do some of the housekeeping up front. I appreciate those I've heard from who seem not to mind, and some people even prefer it this way. On to the housekeeping. I'm taping this in the beginning of December, a couple months after my conversation with Lizzie and Joe. Sometimes the episodes don't come out in the order that the main content is taped for too many reasons to get into. But I cannot believe it is December and 2022 is entering the home stretch. On the last episode, I was encouraging people to vote. Please vote if you live in the U.S., and you did. So thank you, everyone, for voting. No, it wasn't a perfect outcome. The U.S. House of Representatives will still fall under Republican control, but thankfully only by a very slim majority. Nothing like the dozens and dozens of seats that were predicted. The red wave did not materialize. And most importantly, the statewide election deniers were kicked to the curb. That was really scary. And that had me and a lot of other folks looking towards moving outside of the United States. No kidding. Which still may happen at some point. There's such crazy stuff happening here. But for now, things seem cool. Yeah, that pretty much captures it. That's cool for now music. A line I played on keyboard to sound like a klezmer melody. That's from last year's political rap track, Big Lie. And I was just reminded to see if I had any klezmer or Jewish melody lying around, because this is the day after Yee or whatever the hell he's calling himself, went on the Alex Jones show and said, yes, quote, I like Hitler, unquote. That's where we are, folks. Anyway, let's focus on something a little more positive. A few days ago, from when I'm talking to you now, we had the very first Osiris live concert in New York. Osiris, which is our awesome podcast network, has been doing a series of these events. I believe they did one in Seattle. I know they did one in Nashville. They've done several, and it's always a night of music and conversation. And this was the first one in New York. I was humbled to be placed in charge of assembling a band and working with the guests and getting the set together and basically musical directing. One of the guests was Karina Reichman, who is just awesome. I've actually known Karina for about 10 years because she was a star student at a local New York music program where I was a guest artist. I ended up taking her to this camp I gave with Chris Broderick, who was then the guitarist of Megadeth, and Karina played bass and guitar and helped work with the other students. And now she is just hitting her stride. She has a podcast, Inappropriate Happiness. That's right here on the Osiris Network. She could occasionally be seen on late night television sitting in with the Seth Meyers Band. And we've been trying to reconnect for some time. It's been difficult with our schedules, but this show brought us together. Also on the show was Scott Metzger, unbelievable guitar player. Such a good guy. It was great to get to know him. And it's kind of funny that we hadn't met before because we have a lot in common. We both had the same guitar teacher on the East Coast, great jazz guitarist Vic Juras. We don't live far from each other. And actually, I don't want to get too into personal details on the show. That's not my style. I'm not Marc Maron. But somebody very close to him was close to me, but it was a long time ago. And hey, the music world is small, especially when you're dealing with musicians of the opposite sex or the same sex, if that's your thing. Anyway, we totally hit it off. So Scott and Karina were guests, and the core band was Eric Kalb on the drums, Michael Eckroth on the keyboards, who flew up from Florida. Thank you, Michael. And on the bass, Nathan Peck from the Alex Skolnick Trio, who you hear playing bass lines that close out every episode of this show. Anyway, it was a really cool night. I think it'll happen again at some point. But in the meantime, it's going to be turned into a podcast on Osiris. So you'll be hearing more about that soon. So one final thought before I bring in Lizzie and Joe. They are the first hard rock artists I've had on the show. I know that might seem weird or hard to believe, especially for those who think of me as the shredder dude from Testament. But I see this podcast as the opportunity to explore many types of music. And that side of things gets so much oxygen in my career. There's also no shortage of podcasts focused almost exclusively on that. My friend Jamie Josta, for example, goes around to metal festivals and talks to everybody. I can't do that. When I'm on tour, I'm focused on the show. That's where my brain is. So this podcast for me is something different, but it's an honor and a pleasure to welcome Lizzie and Joe as the first hard rock artists. They are great people. They are gracious. They're so gracious, in fact, that I screwed up the interview using a new Zoom-like platform. And I pressed the wrong button, or I forgot to press a button, and it didn't record, and they agreed to reschedule. In fact, they're so down to earth, it's easy to forget that they're a big deal. Grammy winners, sold out shows at large venues, coveted festival spots, radio hits, you name it. And the fact that we had to re-record the podcast, in a way, it made it even better, because in the meantime, I had done the Nightbob episode. And there's a connection between Hailstorm and Nightbob, just like there's a connection between Walter Becker and Nightbob. So it's amazing. That's, to me, one of the purposes of this podcast, Moods and Modes, is to show these connections that you would never know about. Anyway, it is my great pleasure to bring in Lizzie Hale and Joe Hottinger of Hailstorm. Thank you, guys. Thanks for returning.
No, thanks for having us again.
That was so funny, by the way.
It was.
I felt like it was a personal confession that I hadn't hit record. So we know each other much better.
Yes.
That was like real vulnerability right there.
You did great.
Yeah.
You did great.
Thank you. It's great to talk to you some more.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Just a practice run. And now it's like, hey,
yeah,
we know you better. And yeah, this is probably going to be even better than the first time. So
it's going to be better. It's going to be way better. How was your week?
Oh, it was good.
It was a hell of a week. But, you know, here we are in the next week. Mm-hmm. It's been a hell of a half a decade.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Here we go.
And time is going by so incredibly fast. We ended up visiting New York City for the first time in, I can't remember.
Before the pandemic.
Can't remember.
Yeah, how was that? How was your visit?
It was awesome. We're originally from Pennsylvania, so we used to go to the city all the time. And it was just great to kind of be back and feel the energy of the city. It was also just so happened to be Pride weekend. So it was just so joyous.
Oh,
it was everybody,
yeah,
just chaos. And
we just like hiked around the city because we haven't been there forever. Walked like 12, 15 miles just hiking around, going places we haven't been in a while. Oh. You know, it was Pride weekend, Pride Sunday, and it was just wild. Like, and everyone was so happy and so,
yeah,
complimenting everybody, and there's so much joy in the air. It was kind of infectious. It was beautiful.
I feel like you don't always realize how much of the weight of the world that we all feel at any given moment.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's just like we're trying to combat stuff, and it affects you, like, physically. And so it was kind of great to be, like, lost in this, like, celebration, joy, everybody's happy, everyone's giving compliments to each other. It was like we forgot, at least for a day, about all the other craziness and,
yeah,
negativity,
nice,
going on. So soothing for the soul.
Do you guys get into that stuff much? Because I somehow have become part of this group with like Dee Snider, sometimes Nikki Six. It's a really strange group of folks. Tom Morello, Tracy,
yeah,
Guns. Because, yeah, we're just not holding back about opinions.
Yeah.
There's so much pressure not to speak up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's pressure either way. And I feel like, at least for me, I try to pick and choose my moments, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And if there's something that I'm absolutely passionate about, I want to say something. And I never used to be that way. in the early years, I kind of just rode right up the middle.
Right.
And I feel like as the years go on, I've gotten more, I hate to keep using, you know, this just like unbridled joy from just being honest. And a lot of the things that I stand by are fundamental truths, like be kind to one another, you know, that kind of stuff. Uh-huh. But it's gotten to the point today that you can just say that. A challenge for all musicians, just post that fundamental truth. Just like, be excellent to each other, you know, Bill and Ted, come on. And you'll get so much hate for it, for just trying to put out that positivity. So yeah, like I said, pick and choose your moments, be passionate about it, because it really does help a lot of people to know that they're not alone and that you can actually be a voice for a lot of different people that either can't express their opinion or are afraid
to. Just stick to singing, Lizzie.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Yeah. What is this virtue signaling you're doing?
You know, the problem is, like, I don't get into any arguments. I rarely comment, especially when I see friends and people I know say some of the dumbest shit I've ever seen. And I don't say anything, though I want to, just because I always end up feeling worse every time, you know?
Well, you can't get into arguments. To me, it's like, you make your statement, let people do whatever they're going to do with it, but you can't argue with stupid.
And if you don't believe in love is love or being kind and trying to project and put out good energy and good vibe, then, you know, honestly, I don't really need to know you. We've got enough friends. Like, I don't need you in my life.
Yeah, I don't understand. When did being kind become controversial?
Yeah. Yeah.
Also, just be the biggest asshole you can be to as many people. Like, I don't need people like that around. Yeah. Life's too short.
Yeah, I always feel like, you know, it's an elephant in the room.
Always.
If there's a shooting or, you know, a fundamental right just got overturned, you know, affecting half the population. And yeah. I'm kind of the same way now. I choose my battles, but to me, it's really difficult just to ignore it and act like nothing's going on.
Yeah, exactly. There's no way to ignore it. I mean, we're being bombarded every single day with new bad news.
Yeah.
It's hard to ignore it and push it away. And then you end up feeling a little helpless, like I should be doing something about it, because we're so lucky to have this amazing platform where people, for better or worse, are listening to what you have to say. So
yeah,
what are you going to do about it? That's something that you can do.
Yeah, and everything you say is interpreted or misinterpreted. And
there, it's on Blabbermouth.
There you go.
Then you get the feeders. Which those guys crack me up. I love it. I'm like, ooh, what'd they say this time?
I know.
I feel like it used to be more creative, their insults, and they're kind of slacking and they start...
Careful mentioning. They love their name mentioned.
No. They've been sticking to some of the same tropes. And it's
Hailstorm and Alex Skolnick discuss Blabbermouth. Yeah.
Yeah, that's going to be the headline.
And they'll turn it into some clickbait, provocative thing.
Yeah, make something out of it. Yeah.
So last time I was raving about the new record, and I was talking about how it's very clear to me that you played the parts. There's just not a lot of copying and pasting and fixing, even though we all do some fixing, but it's not obvious. It manages to capture the feel of a band playing, which is just so rare, especially for a lot of modern heavy rock.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly refreshing.
Well, thank you, man. Yeah, we always go for it's performance over perfection. You know, there's some things that don't need to be fixed that maybe they were happy accidents. You know, I remember when we were making the demo for
Strange Girl.
Yeah. On the demo, because we were just trying to like get the beats together, something happened with the computer and it flipped the snare drum to the backbeat. And we're like, ooh, happy accidents. We got to make sure that RJ plays that, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's in big part to Nick Raskulinitz, who produced the record.
That's what you said last time. Yeah, he really is a stickler for that type of thing.
Yeah, and that goes for, you know, vocals too. It has to be a performance all the way through, because you're going to be playing and singing that second chorus different. Because you've already had all this buildup. So if you just copy-paste the whole time, I feel like even if the listener, and maybe we just do it selfishly, maybe nobody would ever notice, but I feel like the listener can tell even subconsciously that it's like kind of flatlined the whole way through. So for us, we like doing it that way.
Yeah. I don't think people know that they,
I don't,
you know, you're not consciously thinking, I heard that copy paste, but it gets boring because it's the same exact thing.
Right.
We hear it because, you know, like certain people have inflections. I hear it a lot, in especially with the vocals, about like, okay, well, that definitely came from, you know, like the last chorus, the breath intake, like it, when it's all incredibly the same.
You have trained ears.
Yeah. So we notice, but, you know, and I don't knock anybody that likes to do it that way. There's some bands that have to do it that way and it's easier. And that's just not how we do it. We take the long road.
Yeah. But I also think even people without trained ears, like they might not be able to point out why some music hits harder than others. And why it sounds more, a little more mechanical, but I think they know without knowing.
Yeah.
I've confessed to all you guys about this. The way I first heard of you guys when you won the Grammy, I had no idea who you guys were. And I thought it was another one of these bands where everything's cut and pasted and you guys had beat out, like, I don't know, Motorhead and Maiden. And I'm like, who the hell are these guys? I was schooled very quick. Like, dude, they're really good. You know, I deleted the tweet and it was hilarious. In fact, maybe my problems recording this podcast is karma for that tweet.
I appreciate it, man.
Even on the non-heavy rock songs, I can tell that, like Raise Your Horns, I feel like I'm in the arena.
Oh, that's awesome. So,
can you tell me a little bit about tracking that song?
Yeah. With Raise Your Horns, it was a funny idea that Joe and I were sitting out on the porch during lockdown, because that's what you do. And, you know, it was a little late night. Like, what, you know, I'd love to have a song called Raise Your Horns, but base it off of what that phrase actually means to me. And not just like, hey, heavy metal, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Know? Like posing for a picture. Raise Your Horns! Yeah. Or the stage rap.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. What's the complete opposite of what somebody would expect from that title if they saw it on the back of the record? And so we ended up deciding, like, okay, we're not going to have any drums. There's not going to be a loud guitar. It's going to be a ballad on piano. And like halfway through, I'm just like, do we add instruments or whatever? But it was just always more, just a little bit more powerful with just the vocals and piano, which is something, you know, I'm a cheese ball at heart. So I love a good ballad. But with that one was a little emotional because we were just kind of floating in this purgatory. We didn't have any gigs coming up. And when everything was kind of getting a little lifted and then it would lock down again, so we'd get in the studio, we'd have to get out of the studio. Uh-huh. And it was one of those moments where, like, when I was doing the vocal performance, I got a little choked up about it because I'm standing there with my eyes closed and actually truly feeling what I'm saying and almost trying to recreate that moment that I know is going to happen if we ever get on stage, that moment where I know everyone's going to raise their horns and everyone's going to have that feeling of togetherness and that fellowship. And I got a little choked up about it. And again, like kind of like we were saying before, performance over perfection. And I turned to our producer, I'm like, I think I'm going to have to do that one part again because I got a little choked up. He's like, oh no, we're keeping that.
Oh
no.
Yeah.
So it's funny how like that stuff kind of happens. And as a trained singer, and so there are certain parts like, wait, yeah, was that, you know, is that too human? You know, and it's always, you always err on the side of it being human and it being true to how you're feeling over the perfection. So it was a little bit of an exercise of that as well.
Burn every fear, every doubt like a funeral fire. Scream every anthem and follow your reckless desire. Take back the crown that hangs at the gate. Ready your march, steady your aim. For the heart is a soldier that never loses its way. So raise your horns, raise them high. Let them soar, let them fly up through the
Yeah, and it's sometimes hard to be objective.
Yeah.
Because you have all this, you're inside your own head. You need that producer or trusted ear to let you know, no, this is good. Who cares if it's not perfect or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. And this one was also done as a performance from beginning to end. So I would do, I think it was like 7 takes. We wanted to have that kind of arc of the performance because you're starting very kind of low and quiet, right, and you want it to bloom. And so to find those things, and you know this because you're a performer, but you can almost try to feel where to go and how to let it open up. And if you analyze it, every single chorus is just a little different. You do maybe a different run, you know, vocally, and then, okay, let's take it up a notch and actually pop the octave here. Raise your hand.
That gave me goosebumps. All right, I'm jumping in for just a moment to say that obviously Hailstorm is doing just fine career-wise, but Lizzie could always fall back on a second career singing in church on a Sunday morning.
I see the audience when I listen to that song, though, and I see the lighters, or I guess now it's cell phones. But it just takes you right there.
Oh, thanks, man. I appreciate it. And we were wondering that too, because we were like, okay, if we perform this live, as soon as that chorus hits, I can see everybody raising it. And I'm like, I wonder if I'm right, you know, like, because it's been
too
long. And without fail, now we started playing that song out live. You know, I'll have a small piano section that the boys have named the Miller Halftime Show. Because I'll be and then you see them on the side rooms having a beer or whatever. I still think we should put stools around my piano and you can just have a
Make it a cooler inside.
I love the irony. Yeah, because when I saw the title, Raise Your Horns, I was sure it was going to be like a Judas Priest type thing.
Yeah, you're not the only one. Everyone's I was a little shocked. I was expecting it to be a banger at the end. But
I like ironic things. Yeah, Master of Puppets having a ballad in the middle of the song. And like reconstructing it, like, I always thought that was so brilliant. Another ironic moment, bright side. You know, you're talking about the bright side of life and you're making it clear, yes, everything sucks right now.
Yes, bright side. Ironically, the darkest song on the album. That one was a lot of fun because it, like, that was at that point, you know, for all of these songs, there's like a lot of songs that preceded them, you know, whereas like they're just like the practice runs. I'm a serial drafter and redrafter. So it's like, starts out in a certain way. And then all of a sudden, when you have all the pieces of the puzzle that don't quite fit together, maybe it's like you take certain lines from here, certain lines from there. And that was that song where it's like, we're just like fed up with everything. Yeah. And it's like, you know, so there's a little sarcasm in there, which I always enjoy, and full snarkiness. It's like, this is it. Welcome to your best life, you know?
I really like the lead tone as well.
Do you remember what you used for that?
I can't remember what it was used on. I'm sure it was probably, it was one of the amps, the main amps. It was either the early Marshall with the Tube Screamer or one of those Friedmans or Diesel or the Bogner.
When we were talking last time, you did a run through of all the gear. It sounds like an insane amount of gear that you guys went through. I really like Friedmans myself. I don't own one, but I've used them in studios, and they're always great.
They're awesome. We have one of those little 18 watt.
Yeah, those guys.
They're one of the Jerry Cantrell ones that Dave made. We both have them in a case that we just roll into a backstage room, and it's like our pre-show jam amp scene.
They sound amazing. And you know, if like something happened to one of our amps and whatever, we could just probably just roll that thing on there and make it fucking sound awesome.
Yeah, I have a little pedal. Friedman, which I'm. Thank you for reminding me because I need to bring it. I'm leaving a week from today.
Which Friedman pedal is it?
Hang on one second.
Are you okay?
Sorry, I just saw it right there. I'm like, okay, the small box. It's called.
Oh yeah, I've seen that.
Nice.
Yeah, it's great.
So, how do you use it? What do you use it? Is just like an overdrive or like a boost or?
Yeah, so we're using Kempers. They're just so easy for travel, especially overseas.
Yeah.
I think it sounds a little more convincing, I think, with that box.
Oh, yeah. Killer.
I mean, other ones work as well. I've used different distortion boxes, but when I saw Friedman makes a little box, I'm like, okay, that's got to be the one.
That's awesome.
I know. Well, you know, yeah, that's one of the great debates right now. I don't even know. We're sticklers. We're sticking to tube amps everywhere we go, even when we got to rent them. And I've tried to use the Kemper and stuff on stage.
Axe-FX.
I've tried them, but it's just not.
Yeah, I've tried the Axe-FX. I agree with you there. And I think it's a great sound. It's just, it's like one great sound. It's very hard to change it and find an individual sound.
I use the Kemper down here when we're making demos. Yeah. Nick modeled my red Marshall, my purple Marshall, and a bunch of his amps and kind of gave me the models he made. We went over to Blackbird and did it with one of the guys. And they're close, you know. And they're great to use for demos. You can stack these different amps. And I love the ease of that. I don't have to sit back here and mic stuff up and change out amps, you know, like get the idea out and hustle on it. And it's a demo, so it's not making a record. But yeah. There's a weird sort of pride I have being the loudest person when we play these festivals.
I hear you.
Yeah, we have to turn our amps backward.
The cabinets. Oh,
yeah. The cabinets, yeah. And like clockwork, without fail, because all of the stagehands will be hanging out back there. And then as soon as we start, they all scatter. It just clears it.
Run.
We don't even warn anybody anymore. We're just like, all right.
I wish I could remember the name. My guitar tech or our front of house found these speakers. They used to work for Dickie Betts back in the day. And, you know, Dickie was just deadly loud. There was jokes amongst the crew, like, you don't walk around Dickie's amp, you're going to get hurt. And but he would use these JBL. They're like 250-watt speakers at four of them in his 4x12. And they don't make them anymore, but there's a guy in Spain that is making clones of them. And I wish I could remember his name. But they found him when we got him. And because I was going through speakers, because, you know, it's a 100-watt Marshall from 1971.
Oh,
and it's
nice.
Definitely way more than 100 watts, probably hitting 200. And it's just so incredibly loud and powerful. And we put these speakers in, and the cabinet weighs like 1,000 pounds now, you know. But it, like, there's no distortion from the cabinet. It's just clear as a bell, like whatever the amp is delivering it takes. And it's awesome. And it does, with the cabinet turned backwards, like there have been some. It's like as loud as the festival PA. Like, it's pretty gnarly.
That's so funny. You mentioned the story about Dickie Betts, because I just had a talk with a tech, a legendary tech for the podcast. And he's worked for Aerosmith. He worked for Walter Becker of Steely Dan for a long time. And the Walter Becker story, it's just like Dickie Betts. He was the loudest person on stage. They had to have his cabs over on stage left, like the opposite of like nobody hung out on the side of the stage because they had to keep his cabinets there turned backwards. Same thing.
Were you talking to Night Bob?
Night Bob, yeah.
Oh, I love Night Bob.
You know Night Bob?
We've known him since before we were signed. He ran sound for us a bunch of times.
He saw us one time at Don Hills, and then every time we played, he'd come back and do the sound for us.
Oh, that's so we were crazy. Oh, I wish I knew that.
Yeah, for Atlantic Records. Wow. And we kept playing. We played Don Hill once a month because Don saw us and was like, you guys got to come back. I got to introduce you to people. He's like, come back every, you know, one Wednesday a month and we'll keep, you know, bringing people out. And then Night saw us and then he started hanging out.
That's amazing.
Sweet guy.
Really sweet dude. Yeah, I got to hear a bunch of the
Oh, the stories are incredible. Yeah. This whole thing now feels so cosmic.
Yeah.
We met at this pub, and it's one of the oldest pubs. Anyway, afterwards, we were walking down the street, and there's Don Hills. And it's been closed forever, but it's still got the logos. It's still...
Did you meet at the Ear?
We met at the Ear, yeah.
Is that what that was called?
You know the Ear. Yeah.
That place is great.
That's so cool you guys know him and know that place. And
we should have gone to the Ear while we were in town.
What were we doing?
We got to go back.
No, there's never enough.
Is the Ear still there?
The Ear is still there, yeah. We went. That's where we went.
That's
so make a note for next time.
Yeah, those were fun times, man. I mean, I feel like just between Nightbob and then Don Hill, just between those two guys, I mean, that was a huge reason that we started to get noticed in the city.
I hate to interrupt, but we're about at the midway point, a little past the half hour. We're going to go extra long today because we have so much hailstorm. And the story about Lizzie and Joe and the band meeting up with Nightbob and Don Hill, the club owner, and the effect that that had on their career is pretty amazing. So you're going to hear that right on the other side of this. Just a couple quick announcements since we did most of the housekeeping up front. The final concert of the year for me is December 16th at New Blue in New York City with the Alex Kolnick Trio. So if you're in the city or the New York tri-state area, please come out. We'd love to see you. And don't forget, in January, first thing that's happening is the Joe Satriani G4 Experience in Las Vegas, presented by Dreamcatcher Events. I am so thrilled to be a part of this. It includes such young upstarts as Peter Frampton and Steve Lukather. Okay, maybe they're not exactly young upstarts, but on the younger side of things, we do have Mateus Asato and Corey Wong and Neely Brosh, and in between, Eric Gales, myself, John Five, the new guitarist of Motley Crue, by the way, and others. I can't even name them all. I'm so thrilled to be in such company, and I look forward to this event. I just found out Jordan Rudis is going to be there playing keyboards. Joe's whole band is going to be there, and tickets are still available. Makes a great Christmas gift. Oh, and let's not forget Joe Satriani himself curating the whole thing. I imagine we're going to get an episode or two of Moods and Modes out of this. So really look forward. And now let's get back to my conversation with Lizzie Hale and Joe from Hailstorm.
It was literally Don Hill. Like, wow. So we went up to showcase for something, didn't work out. And Don was like, hey, you guys have to meet my lawyer. He's going to get you a record deal. Trust me. I haven't seen a band like you come through here in a while. You know, he was really sweet. So we met his lawyer, and guy was like, yeah, let's go. He's like, come back next week. We'll bring your acoustic. We'll go to Epic. We'll go to Columbia. And we're like, all right, let's go. You know, we went up there, and then we played that night, and he brought out Lee Lust from Atlantic Records. He's like, I think this is your guy. Those were just warm-ups, and Lee was great. You know, we spent the next 6 months. We must have showcased for Atlantic, like, 20 times.
It was awesome because it was a personal mission to, like, it was always happening at Don Hill's. And we were living in Pennsylvania at the time. So it's like, whatever, a 4-hour ride. And we would gather up all of our super fans in Pennsylvania. We'd rent a van and get them drunk and take them to Don Hill's. So it looked like we had a following in New York City, even though we totally didn't.
Oh, what a great idea.
Yeah. So the place would be like filled with people. And they were all people that were our fans. So it was just like the excitement of it. But.
Man, I remember the rats running around.
Oh, I know. There were rats in the rafters. They're like, oh, God.
Oh, yeah. Welcome to the city.
Yeah,
but they were like rats the size of cats, man. It was crazy. Wasn't it Josh, our bass player, Josh, like just kept an eye on it? Like, I don't know. Are the rats going to fall from the rafters and be part of the show? Just chasing them around stage.
That would have been a hell of a show.
That would be great. We should just start that. Just unleash the rats.
See what the crowd does.
Well, I think the band Rat had a video like that.
Oh, did they?
Except I think they were playing in a house. Yeah. And then the rats awesome. Come out.
Our producer, Nick, loves Rat. He loves Rat.
Literally his favorite band.
Yes.
Yeah. Those are great sounding records. Great guitar playing.
Yeah.
I met Don Hill once, but yeah, I never played there. I had no idea you guys had history there. And the fact that you knew Nightbob is so cool.
That's so serendipitous.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
We either met Nightbob there or we met him because he was working with Silvertide.
I feel like we met him
when they started out and had all their hype going. Remember that band Silvertide?
No.
Or Philly band? Clive Davis signed him this huge record deal. and Nightbob road managed them. And there are these kids playing like this amazing Aerosmith type blues rock. They were just incredible. Wow. Like Nick Perry and Walt, I mean, they were rock stars, you know, they look great. They're killer on stage and they're great players and got on a bunch of killer tours. Nick just made a record.
Still doing
what happened?
Something didn't work out. Didn't connect. You never know.
Aren't they getting back together?
That I know. Nick is still playing.
I know so many stories just like that.
Yeah, Nick.
Well, that brings up a question. So for every hailstorm, right, there are how many silver tides?
So many.
There are so many. I mean, we saw it happen when we were making our first record. We were stuck in California. And that was a whole thing. And this was in 2008.
2007.
2007.
2008.
Through 2008. And we saw, I mean, even on Atlantic, I mean, that was when the industry was changing. And I mean, all of our peers were getting dropped left and right. Yeah. To the point that, like, every time that we would hear about that, we'd be like, well, we're probably next in the list, guys. You know, and we would go get like a bottle of champagne. We're like, all right. And we might be going home.
Drink
I don't
up
know.
Now.
And,
bombs away.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. It was an interesting time, and it's definitely not lost on us that, I mean, there's a lot of hard work, of course, but there's a lot of luck that goes into that too. And we didn't know if we were going to connect to anybody, you know, it's like we had been out on tours and all that. And then now you're making your first record and be like, I don't know, it could be great and people could want more, you know, or the industry changes and all of a sudden nobody wants to hear you anymore. I don't know. It's such a crapshoot. There's no guarantee.
It still
guarantee.
Feels like a crapshoot.
Oh,
like,
of course. Every single time you release
live rock and roll, like, just going to keep going? I don't know.
Yeah.
Let's just enjoy it.
Yeah.
Well, I think that attitude right there, that helps explain part of it, right? Because it's so difficult and it's so unglamorous the majority of the time.
Except for that 1 hour, 90 minutes.
Yeah, that little brief little time you're on stage or in a video or an award show. That's such a tiny fraction of it. And it's not easy. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of bands don't realize that until they get in it. And then there are some bands that, like, you know, you get together. We're really lucky that we all still like each other. You know, we all still hang out. We still have a lot of fun together and we laugh to the point of tears nearly every single day on
that's
tour.
Amazing.
Just keeping that up too, because I think a lot of people that doesn't always work out, whereas like you all of a sudden you're living 2 feet from your bandmates, you know, and you're like,
I don't like them anymore. I don't like you.
We've been on tour with bands like that. I remember I'd be having a conversation with one of the bands that we're touring with, and we're like, oh, Lizzie, what are you going to do for the day off? And I'd say something like, I don't know, the guys and I usually maybe we'll go bowling or we'll see a movie together. And they literally stopped me like, wait, together?
They're
like,
in shock.
We're not just like going on your own. I'm like,
you guys like each other? Like what?
Yeah, exactly. It's a weird thing. I feel like that helps too, because as you're going through all of this immense and intense roller coaster ride that is this journey of being a musician and trying to maintain, you know, we've hit a lot of walls. We've had a lot of ups and downs, and nobody knows that journey and what it takes besides the four of us. Like nobody knows on the outside of the four of us what we've actually been up against. And so to have that kind of understanding, and especially for me, like, and that support from my guys. And I have this thought far too often now, like if I had started out and I was just going to be a solo artist, which I was always deadly against. There are a lot of people like, oh, no, you should lose the band and just do this, or you should go pop, or you should do this. And I was always just, you know, a stickler. I'm like, no, I'm keeping my guys. We're in this together. I want to rock. It's funny because now I think about it. If I had listened to them, you know, because like, oh, whatever, it's up to you and I need your advice. I don't know if I could have made this on my own, you know, because it must be so difficult for solo artists, because especially coming up. Because now all of a sudden, the only people that you have surrounding you are the yes people.
The people that you're paying.
So they're just going to agree with whatever. And you can't really find that true, you know, brutal honesty that you need when in a band. Like we keep the communication lines open. You know, if somebody's having a problem, we're like, all right, we're going to deal with it now. We don't let anything fester. I don't think we are physically able to do that anymore.
Yeah, I can't shut up.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Well, also, if you had done that you would be like so many other singers.
Exactly.
Right? There's just no shortage of individual pop singers that have a writing team.
Yep.
And they're kind of dictated to about how they should sound, you know, for a large part of it. Yeah, what you're doing is so much rarer.
I feel like, and this is something that dates back to before we started the band and like when I'm trying to navigate through middle school and all of that and understanding that I'm not necessarily like the other girls. And
I imagine you were never like the other girls. I just
definitely not. And I discovered that from an early age.
Yeah,
but
figured.
It's interesting because even when you're trying to make your band happen and trying to figure out where you fit, well, instead of trying to figure out where you fit, well, where's the hole? What's the thing that isn't there that you don't see?
Right.
And for me, coming up in Pennsylvania and we're playing bars and whatever, there was the people that wanted to be like acoustic singer-songwriter, like Jewel and all of that back in the day. And then there was the bluesier Sheryl Crows in the scene, like not literally Sheryl Crow, but they wanted to be that. And then there was like, there were some metal singers, but it was a lot of like that. It's either like super operatic European metal, or they were girls that would be doing like Disturbed covers and that stuff. And so I didn't see myself in any of these people. And I didn't see on a local level and even on a broader term level, like I had to go back and listen to those foremothers of rock for inspiration because there wasn't really someone that I saw myself in, you know? So you almost have to invent it, you know? You have to be like, okay, you know, I'm going to sing like this. I'm going to put myself into this hard rock vein because I love this genre so much, but there's nobody out there like me. So that's kind of cool. And I remember, you know, when I was a teenager being kind of pounded into my head, and I was very lucky to have strange parents as well, and that were encouraging of all of that. And I remember my dad saying something to the effect that, yeah. I remember my dad saying something to the effect that nothing great ever happens if you're just trying to fit in. You know, you always need to stand out for something great to happen. And so it got to the point where it became kind of a personal mission statement. Even like the things that I was wearing, if I saw a lot of other people wearing that same thing, I'm like, all right, I'm not wearing that anymore. You know, it's like, never with the trends. I'm still not. I have a mishmash of, I don't even know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it just becomes one of those things where you just keep finding, you keep following what you love and you keep doing it.
I guess RJ took that advice too.
Oh, definitely. RJ has always been totally fine just standing out. I think he was born like, where's the camera? I'm camera ready.
And I'm just going to jump in for one moment to elaborate for anybody who might not know. RJ is the band's drummer. RJ Hale, the other Hale in Hailstorm, and also Lizzie's brother. And in contrast to the music, which can be quite dark and intense at times, RJ is a ham. He gives new meaning to the word ham in terms of how he dresses and his jokes. He has a great sense of humor, as you'll hear about right now.
We were in one of these collaboration videos with a bunch of different artists.
Oh, yeah.
He just like stole the show. It's like at one point it stops and he just does this crazy monologue and it's hilarious. Like, who is this guy?
We've always encouraged him to just be himself. And
he could do a one man show, I think.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It would be hilarious.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I know, with all of his horrible dad jokes, they're so bad.
Terrible.
I remember we were at a festival in Australia and RJ is a good personality gauge if you're meeting somebody new. Like, people either absolutely think he's wonderful or they don't understand him at all and are annoyed by it, right? So we were in catering and RJ comes out in this pink pineapple suit with these crazy flamingo glasses thing, and we're at like a metal festival, so everybody's in black, and he walks into catering and this drummer from another band literally was like, what? He came right up to him, just like up to RJ's, what are you wearing? And of course I get my back up a little bit because like, that's my little brother. You don't make fun of him. I make fun of him.
Yeah. Right.
And, he said he was like, one week on the road with us and you won't be wearing that shit anymore.
Well, no, he said, give us 1 hour and we will break you of that. And RJ, he's like, gets his silent revenge back. because that particular drummer was going to watch our set that night. And so what does RJ do? Instead of going and changing into something that's black, he found, where did he find it? He found this like Viking helmet and all these like Mardi Gras beads on. And he's
like tinfoil in his teeth and like he had a like grill.
Like a grill?
I just put my arm out of it because RJ.
Like Little John, the rapper.
RJ's like, I'm like, good for you, bro. He's like, yeah, that guy doesn't have the balls to wear what I'm wearing right now. I'm like, hell yeah. I'm so proud. Such a proud artist for that day.
Oh my God. Was this in Europe or the US?
Australia. Yeah.
Hilarious. That was
totally hilarious. We started to talk about guitars last time. You told me in the studio you sort of went through a whole bunch of guitars, but you narrowed it down to a couple of guitars. And then, of course, we have this great new signature Gibson Explorer Bird to talk about. So tell me a little bit about those in any order you choose.
Well, between the two of us, how many guitars we had? Like 97 guitars or something like that. So we brought everything to the studio just because why not?
More guitars.
Yeah, always. And then I think we bought a few during the process, but it got to the point where like there was nowhere to sit down because we ran out of guitar stands and racks. And so then all of a sudden we had to turn to the couches and the chairs and be like, all right, that one's there. But yeah, it would just be a shootout every time. And there's like a pile, a very messy pile of pedals and then, you know, all the amplifiers. And so we would kind of choose as we go, like just like, okay, try that one.
Well, it's great.
That's not right.
It's great having them all, you know, in front of you. Like between us and Nick, Nick's guitar, Nick's got a great guitar collection and amp collection too. And you know, there was like well over 100 guitars in there and everything's out of its case and kind of around.
Wow. So
you can, you know, you're like, all right, this is the part. What are we doing? And like, I haven't played that one in a while. Let's try that. And cool. Oh, no, let's go back to Les Paul or let's hit the Explorer or the SG or this one needs a Strat or a nice, cool, clean Tele thing, you know?
And
it's just fun. It's like being a kid in a candy shop.
And it takes a while to get a sound. I mean, people don't realize that. I just did a session for a friend, just a little guitar solo part. And I had to go through my whole pile here just to find something that would fit.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't happen like that.
It's not just playing, you know, that's a part of the whole process, obviously, but it takes a while. You got to get the mics right and what mics are you using and what preamps are you running through and how's it entering the board? And then what amps is it? And are they talking, complimenting each other, you know.
Which takes a lot of thought and a lot of time not playing. And so much of it is that. It's organizing, figuring out gear, getting sounds, playing one chord, turning knobs.
Making a record isn't like, it's a slope. It takes a while for a reason, you know. I'm a fairly impatient person, generally speaking, and like, I used to get frustrated in a studio. I'm like, come on, like, why can't we knock out a song? And like, song a day, let's do it. And it's
I'm ready. I'm feeling it. Yeah, come on.
All right, hold on. You know, and it's always, Nick has such a good pace because he makes sure you don't burn out, you know, and keeps the vibe up. And you hustle too hard like that and you're going to burn out fast because it's intense. They're long days. And so there's always like, you know, oh, let's just, hey, listen, do you ever listen to this record? Let's listen to this, listen to this stuff, you know, or just listen to records. And, you know, meanwhile, Nate, the engineer's in there getting the next thing ready. And I don't know. It's good.
Yeah, it's cool. It's tough when you hit that wall and all of a sudden it's like you can't even hear what you're trying to do anymore. And we've been in studio sessions like that where it's like we're just beating our head against a wall and it's like we can't even tell if it's right now because you've just been doing the same thing. You know, it's like trying to figure out this same box. So yeah, like Joe said, Nick's really good at pivoting. Be like, okay, we're getting.
He sounds great. This guy, Nick
Raskulinis.
He sounds really positive and great to work with.
Yeah, he's a dude. He's one of the good guys out there. You know, there's a few.
I mean, his track record is legendary. Yeah. I mean, between the Foo Fighters and Queens of the Stone Age,
last
two Rush records,
Alice in Chains.
Wow. You know, he is who he is. He doesn't like put on a different hat to hang out with people. I think he wears his emotions on his sleeve and he's such a fan of all the bands that he works with. He can see himself front and center down as a fan in the crowd, and he brings that energy to us. I mean, just recording in the studio, like, he'll be right next to you the whole time. You're like, all right, And again, what we were talking about before, that performance over perfection. Like, okay, here we go. We're coming into the first course. I'm going to need one skadoosh. Then I start rare on the next. We're going to go triple
skadoosh.
Go, go. You know, and so keeping that momentum going. And then with my little brother on the drums, he'll be in with a stick and just like almost conducting, playing along with him, just keeping that, you know, keeping everybody excited and making it fun, because those things are fun to do. It's like you can get so into your own head with just like, okay, like we're almost, you don't play like yourself, you know? Like I know you know that goes in the studio. We're almost like...
You can overthink.
Yeah, and it's like now all of a sudden it's very mechanical.
Forget to have fun.
Yeah, so he keeps a grand balance with that.
Yeah.
Recommend him to anybody.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned that. I love the new record.
Thank you.
It's heavy. It hits hard. Can we just do like a lightning round on the songs that we haven't discussed?
Absolutely.
All right. Back from the Dead.
Yeah.
Obviously, that's coming out of lockdown and COVID. And
yeah.
On the edge of the world, getting lost in oblivion. Till the devils are trying to keep me living like a prisoner.
I mean, seriously, it was almost a pep talk because I went through a couple different depressive states and all that during the whole thing. I don't think you really realize how much you use all of those things, like the touring, the live shows, the camaraderie with your bandmates, the forward movements,
the fans.
And you don't realize how much you use all of those things as weapons in your arsenal to like just combat that darkness. So for me, it was almost trying to like predict the future and be like, okay, when I am on stage, what do I want to say? What's the war cry of survival? That song went through a couple different drafts. I think the first one was called It's Alive or something like that. You found an old picture of me drafting lyrics. But anyway, finally put the puzzle together. And as soon as that song was done, we're like, okay, unless we beat it with something really crazy, this has to be the first song on the record. It has to be the first one that goes out. So we ended up releasing that before we were even done with the record.
Yeah,
we
released last it on radio. August or something.
Yeah. I ended up using my Explore Bird on that one just because it stayed in tune and license and drop C. So
yeah,
that one was a beast for that. But yeah, love it.
All right, Wicked Ways.
Wicked Ways. We just did a video for this
song. Yeah, it's the next single. I love the breakdown in the bridge is something we've never done before. Like, you know, your triplet.
Yeah, it's totally unpredictable.
It's a nice turn. That's one of our favorite riffs to play live. That's so much fun. And then the crowd just goes nuts at that part too, because it's like it halts and then you just kind of slingshot them into that part. It's really fun. But yeah, I mean, you know, lyrically with this is where my dark and light can kind of form a truce. Or, you know, I'm not inherently evil. I'm not a bad person, but
you have your weakness.
I can be me.
Everybody's got the little devil and the little angel. Yeah. On the shoulder.
Yep. Sometimes you got to listen to him.
As Strange Girl, that's like what we were talking about before. You said you weren't like the other girls in school. I'm sure that song will probably be relatable to quite a few young ladies.
It's been amazing getting the feedback from that particular song. And there's so many people that have some of the lines tattooed on them now. And it's great. That one was a surprise. I wasn't sure if like people were really going to gravitate toward that. But that was directly inspired by a conversation that I had with a 15-year-old little girl artist chick online. And she was having a hard time. She was in lockdown with some very emotionally abusive parents. And she was reaching out online to try to talk about that. So kind of took that conversation into one of our writing sessions. And I want to give her an anthem, not a ballad. something that she can wake up every morning and be like, okay, I'm able to own myself, own my weird, own what makes me different, own my truest self. And also, Lizzie's got my back because she's a strange girl too. So it's just, you know, just being there. Yeah. It was fun. Then I ended up telling her, I'm like, there's a song on the album that's for you. I'm not going to tell you which one. You can take me straight to hell. You can crucify my name. You can throw me to the walls. You can burn me in the flame and say, she's such a strange girl. Such a strange girl. The world needs strange girls just like me. Kiss me out of bed and write me off the dead.
That song is one of those experiments with, like, I'm obsessed with, like, big rock. Like, how is this going to sound in a huge arena or something? You know, like,
oh yeah, the riff.
You know, just like this wall. That one is just a wall, and it's fun to play live because it is, you know, big dumb. You know, and it's not. I don't say that it's dumb, but it's just so big and wide. It's hard for me to slow down like that and try to write that.
Then I ended up using a vocoder on this song too, which I never used before. So that was fun. But fun and strange.
Nice. Bright Side, we already talked about. The Steeple.
It's a pentatonic bulldozer.
Right up the middle.
Yeah, that was one of those songs where, again, we're like trying to just recreate the church of rock and roll that we believe in so much and that we were missing so much. And that feeling, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to take it. I've heard a lot of our fans are taking it, not necessarily as an ode to the rock show, but, you know, battling depression and what, and that fellowship that you feel at a live show where you can physically feel that cloud being lifted when you're either watching something or if you're playing it, there is that amazing relief that you feel when you're surrounded by people just like you and everyone's screaming their favorite song. And it was just missing that so much. So in a selfish way, we're just trying to recreate that feeling and actually talk about it. This is my church and these are my people. Another one of my favorite solos of yours on this record.
Yeah, that was a fun one to put together. I think I had a janky fill-in solo on that song too, and I was like, it's not good enough.
Yeah, well, it's because of the Back from the Dead solo that we were already getting it mastered.
It was mastered. It was
it
done.
It was already done.
You know, I showed the song to a friend of mine in another band, and as soon as I got the solo, I realized, like, oh no.
It wasn't the right thing.
Like, that's not the right thing. Like, she's ripping. And this solo didn't add anything to the song for sure. And I was like, Nick, I got to redo it, man. I'm sorry. Give me a day. I'm going to figure it out and compose it. Because the other one was just kind of winging it, improvising in the studio. And we're like, that'll do. And
Which can work for certain parts, sometimes, for certain songs.
Sometimes you just nail it. You know exactly what to do with it. That one and Steeple, I really like spent some time composing. And like, all right, let's use some of the melodic themes that she's singing, but give it a band thing and some of the like similar riff type things, we do it in a different way, work it and then get a lick in there, you know?
We recorded this album differently than the way we normally do. And I ended up doing all of the Keeper vocal takes to the demos before we ended up building it up for real musically, which is like the opposite. You're like building the pyramid upside down, I guess, but it...
Yeah, so it was all built around the vocal.
Not that I need any more attention, obviously. but
that actually makes perfect sense to me because, in a way, right? It's supposed to interact with
the
cherry on the sundae.
Yeah, exactly. The cherry on the sundae. Yeah. So the cherry was in place. And so it was actually really kind of fun to almost have that as your roadmap. You know, it's like, so you're being inspired by certain melodies or little breaks here and there. Okay, well, how do we fill that up? You know, instead of kind of imagining it and then right, Lizzie, last person in, you get in the booth and sing on top of everything. So
it makes total sense to me, and it was fun to work around it because the vocals are there and the harmonies. So you already like any candy, any top, you know, let's get some high information here. You know where it works and where it doesn't work, you know, and what needs to be filled in. And you know, like you think of Hailstorm, you think of Lizzie Hale. It should, she's the front of it. You know, you're coming out this way. Like in the song Bombshell, like we wrote 20, 30 songs before we even got to that one. Yeah. And sometimes like I'll put a track together and be like, hey, here's this music. I think it's cool. And
put
something on it. And sometimes it's just like you're singing to the music, you know, you let the music drive. And then there's times like in Bombshell, I gave you that. And then it's like you took the wheel, you know, and made it the engine. And like a flower. Just grabbed it and went forward. And so recording that way with you in front, it's amazing because then you're always, to me, where you should be, like at the front. You're the singer, you're the
well, because there is that thing that happens, you know, and I it happens musically too, but absolutely with vocals. It's like when you're writing something and it's new and you have like the concept and the idea and you put that together, there's this excitement that happens that shows in the recording that after months and months of you like hearing the songs and then you're building up the tracks and whatever, you're going to sing it in a different way and you're going to play it in a different way once you're like used to it. And sometimes some of that magic gets lost. So it's important.
Cool. Tell me about Terrible Things.
Terrible Things. Terrible Things, lyrically, it is just still trying to maintain some faith in humanity when you're surrounded by so much hate for hate's sake, and we're still fighting over these petty differences that shouldn't matter. I think it was important for us to have a song on this record that was a little bit, not a love ballad, but not really a ballad, but something a little bit more talking about the weight of the world. You know, most
without
people
being
have,
preachy.
Without being preachy, but just an observation. And this was a song that my friend Scott Stevens had started a couple years ago, and it was called I Am Terrible Things. It was like very disparaging. Like, I'm such a horrible person, you know? And I'm like, bro, I love where this song is going, but I can't sing that. So we ended up rewriting the whole thing to Terrible Things. And I see terrible things. And here's the wickedness of the world. And here's the hole that we're in. But I have to maintain that faith. So there is that, you know, in my dreams, I believe that we are not these terrible things and that we can fix this and we can be good again.
I see terrible things. I see a sickness in a world on its knees. It will take what you love like a thief. But in my dreams, I believe we're not these terrible things. Terrible things.
Even though, since we finished that song, it seems like that's not the prediction. It just keeps going.
Keep believing. So, keep believing.
Hanging on by a thread. But that was a beautiful one to perform. And Joe, you were doing some finger picking in there, just showing a different side terrible of yourself, which was awesome.
Yeah, so, I mentioned last time, I love the acoustic tone on the record.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, yeah.
It was a Martin, right?
Yeah, what did you
I have this Martin 18 golden era with sinker mahogany, like 200 or 300 year old mahogany that they found in Belize or something. They just made a handful of them for Guitar Center. I'm like,
and you got one.
And I got one. Yeah. That was when I was going through the, all right, I want, like, I need a great acoustic. I need a great Strat, a great Tele, a great Les Paul, you know, like just building up the beginnings of my arsenal. And
I can relate.
Yeah. Right. You gotta have,
It's
got a magical thing to it, like the balance, the bass, the bracing inside is the same bracing they did in the 30s Martin. And it's just, there's no pickup or input jack or anything. It's just a really light, resonant piece of wood, you know? And it's balanced. I don't know. It's a beautiful guitar. So we mic'd it up. Just, you know, it's so crispy. It's fun to record that stuff. You know, you got your headphones on and you can hear the chair creak, you know? Like, it's just, you're in it.
It's a very distinct sound.
Yeah.
All right. Tell me about My Redemption.
That one's a banger. That's
just all,
all riffage all the time.
Kind of the opposite of that big rock thing I was talking about.
Yeah, filling it up.
Just going.
Yeah, there's also an insane amount of words, which what I wasn't thinking about when we were putting it together is that on stage, I'm going to need oxygen at some point. Not like, but just like breathing. I'm going to need to inhale.
Right. You need to breathe. You need to catch a breath.
It's like, yeah. Jesus. Yeah. I'm like, what did we do to ourselves? We did not take it easy. I set it on fire. I laid it to rest. Kissed to the hurt so I wouldn't forget. My heart can survive it. I'm stronger than this. I needed to write that song. I was doing a little self-forgiveness exercise and decided to put that into a song.
Very important.
Yeah. You know, it's like we all make mistakes. Things aren't. And it's like I can spiral out just mentally with myself. Like I can talk myself in or out of doing things, you know, and worrying about things that I either can't change or happened a while ago. And this was a form of therapy for me to get through that. But again, I had far too much to say about that. And there's just a lot of words. Like every time we play it, all right, here comes this rapid fire part. Let's go. But
Bombshell is right next to it, which is sort of like the complete opposite.
There's the opposite.
There's the opposite of that.
That started out as on a voice memo. I was tuning up. Nick had the 70s Les Paul custom. And we had to plug it into this diesel or something. And I was tuning up the high E string and the tuning peg failed. The gears stripped. It just went fully slack. Oh no, Nick, I broke your guitar.
Oh no.
I hit the string, you know, just slack, kind of barely, maybe even a little bit stuck to the pickup, you know. And it was like, meow, 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 meow. I was like, that sounds cool. It's like super... It was like,
oh, I love
massive
it.
Sounding, but the tiniest string is deadly loose.
You're barely touching it.
So I put it, because you touch it,
so wide. Yeah.
Like, that's a cool riff. That sounds amazing. Put it in my phone and finally got to working on it during the pandemic and kind of put this track together. And so we were talking about earlier, she took it into her little vocal scene.
Like,
and
I think I have a musical bed for this. I'm like, awesome. So then I'm like, let me see what I can do. I went through a couple different things. And then finally I'd been thinking about it a lot. This is kind of what we were talking about before, about having an opinion when it's just, you know, the whole shut up and sing thing or shut up and play. And I just figured, I'm like, well, I can always have the last word if I write a song about it. So this was kind of my middle finger to that. And it just went.
Yeah.
It felt like it, even though like I was writing on top of your bed of music, it felt like it just fit, you know, like it was meant to be that. So,
it was meant to be.
Yeah. 'Cause we don't like when you speak up. You speak up. Just bite your tongue and give it up. Give it up. Well, I got news for all of you fools. You're best.
Next time we're at the same show, we'll hang for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I appreciate you doing this with us, man. It's so much fun talking with you. And
oh, I'm so glad to hear
delightful.
That.
It's awesome. I'm almost glad we got this like second hang, you know?
It's almost a blessing.
Yeah.
It is. It was meant to happen.
Yeah. Great to talk to you guys.
Thanks.
All right.
Bye.
How cool was that? And how cool are they? I really enjoyed hearing about how the songs are created, especially the one that started out with the broken tuning mechanism on the guitar and led to a riff that went boom, boom. And we actually went on. We had a whole talk about cameras, me and Joe. But it was kind of inside baseball. So I'm going to save that for bonus footage. And just a final thought. I know a lot of folks listen to us because we tend to focus on music that falls out of the purview of what is considered commercial or accessible. There's going to be occasional exceptions. Lizzie and Joe clearly feel the music that they're doing and their songs. They're not phoning it in. And hey, if the music that you're actually feeling happens to result in chart-topping singles, millions of streams for your videos and albums, Grammy Awards, and sold-out shows at massive venues, hey, as long as it's sincere, ain't nothing wrong with that. And now it's time to read us out. Moods and Modes is presented by Osiris Media, hosted and produced by yours truly, Alex Skolnick. Production for Osiris by Kirsten Cluthie, editing and mixing by Justin Thomas. Artwork by Mark Dowd, original music by yours truly, Alex Skolnick, here on this outro, joined by Nathan Peck on the bass and Matt Zabrowski on the drums. Other musical clips throughout by our guests, Hailstorm, not hard to find, by the way. Google them. And their new album is called Back from the Dead. And if you hear this before December 12th and you're a listener in London, catch them with Alter Bridge at a little dive bar called the O2 Arena. That's it for our Hailstorm episode. Thanks again to Lizzie and Joe. Thank you for listening. Please hit subscribe or follow if you haven't. And we'll see you on the next episode. Take care. December? Wow. The year is... Oh, Jesus. Shut up. Shut up. Hey!
Osiris.
Hey listeners, I want to tell you about the April-May 2023 issue of Relics Magazine. It features a Dave Matthews Band cover story with additional articles and interviews with The National, Graham Nash, Wayne Shorter, ALO, Ivan Neville, our friend Eric Krasno and Stanton Moore, Marty Stewart, and much more. Check out the latest version of Relics and subscribe now at relics.com/DMB. Thanks, Relics.
Hi, I'm Emma.
And I'm Joe.
And we're the professional book nerds. Two Mondays a month, we interview authors and talk about their upcoming books, what drives them, and their go-to order at the cafe.
On Thursdays, we share recommendations and dive into topics readers face, like how do I actually read the books on my to-be-read list?
You can find the Professional Book Nerds podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Want to learn more about us? Our website is professionalbooknerds.com, and you can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at ProBookNerds.
We hope you'll come and listen, and as always,
happy reading.